This is TWiT.
So, Josh, we've got a lot of things to talk about on the patent front, some specific cases that are in the news these days, and also some more general policy discussion we can have about patent law and what's going on. Why don't we start from the general and go to the Pacific, sorry, not to the Pacific, that's where I am here in California, to the specific, and talk about some big issues in patent reform and why it's an important issue that we keep bringing up on the show. You have a post up on Patent Progress about NPEs, non-practicing entities, being, you know, more evidence that these are, first of all, these are often known as patent trolls, why they're not good for innovation. So for folks who aren't already familiar with all of the concepts I just mentioned, why don't you bring us up to speed on that front, Josh?
Sure. So the basic idea of an NPE, or sometimes you'll hear patent assertion entity, PAE, or patent troll, they all get used in slightly different ways, but fundamentally refer to some company that doesn't make anything but does make patents that they then litigate and assert against other companies. And their real business model is licensing those patents out. So the question has always been, what's the impact of that? You know, there's nothing illegal about doing it, but is it good for innovation? Do they pay inventors enough to justify the negative impacts or not? And there's a recent paper from a few professors who've been looking at a lot of evidence, and I wrote a bit about it and linked to the paper. It's definitely worth reading. Looking at what happens with practicing entities, what happens with operating companies once they've been sued, how do they change their spending on research and development, how do they change their spending on new products? And the answer they came up with is that there's a real negative impact, that these firms generally reduce their spending. They reduce how much they're willing to spend on research and development, which makes sense. If you think there's a risk that your research and development spending is just going to create new risks for you, it ceases to have as much value. So you see this negative impact. The counter question is, well, the NPEs, at least in theory, do pass their money. You know, they have to pay for those patents somehow. So the inventors at some point are getting rewarded in theory. The problem is that that theory doesn't seem to play out. There isn't any real marker that NPEs actually pay inventors in a way that generates more innovation.
Right. And then when they get the patents, other people who are attempting to innovate often find themselves ground to a halt by the litigation process.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, by litigation and also by the threat of assertion, and to a sort of a higher level extent, the idea of a blocking patent is that a patent doesn't allow you to do anything. All it allows you to do is prevent somebody else from doing something. So the fact that I own a patent, I don't own a patent, but if I did own a patent, it doesn't mean that I can do what I've patented. If somebody else holds a patent on something that I need to do what I patented. So the sort of the simple example is, if somebody else has patented ham, I could still patent a ham sandwich, but I can't make a ham sandwich without getting a license from the ham owner. What that winds up doing is that if there's a lot of patents in a space, it becomes harder and harder to build on it, to innovate, because there's always the risk that some basic building block has been patented and that you won't actually be able to do anything once you've innovated, even if you go out and seek your own patent.
Right. And I guess one of the answers to that problem is the whole open source movement and having certain intellectual property ideas that are available for use because they're not tied up with patent. That movement has been around for a long time. What do you make of its current health and welfare?
I think the open source movement is, I'm trying to think of how to say this. I think that it's really, at this point, it's proven that it is a viable model. There's no different projects may come and go, but the idea that open source is a workable way to develop software is pretty much, I don't think anyone could really argue with that. But that that movement still has some problems with patents. The fact that something is open source doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't going to be challenged by a patent. It's something that I think a lot of open source companies think very deeply about. So Red Hat is a CCIA member, and it is an issue that they care about. They worry. There's the blanking on the meaning of the acronym, but the LOT network is a lot of open source companies have participated in, and it's basically a commitment against their patents ever being asserted against open source products, particularly Linux, but in general open source.
Right, because the ham sandwich problem doesn't go away just because you're dealing with something right. That's been open sourced. If all the patents involved in what's been open sourced haven't been cleared, then you're still going to be in trouble.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of the open source licenses have started to think about this issue, so they make sure that contributors to the open source project give an effective license to users of the project. But they can't bind somebody who didn't contribute to the project. They can't bind somebody who didn't participate. And in some ways, it's analogous, and I think we'll talk about this a little later, to standard essential patents and how that interaction between contributors to the standard and their patent ownership works.
Right. And don't they make the contributors to the open source project also warrant that their contributions are original and aren't relying on other IP?
I think that's usually more in the copyright context, but and it also depends on the open source project. Some don't make any warranties whatsoever. I think the larger projects are much more careful about it, especially now.
All right. Well, I'm sort of veering us away from patent trolls here and whether or not they're good for innovation. Matt, did you take a look at this and do you have any questions for Josh?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's an interesting area. I think that, you know, just to broaden the perspective, you know, there is academic debate about the value of patents in general. So, you know, the subset of people who aren't practicing with their patents, you know, certainly would come under greater scrutiny. What are some of the structural things that we could do? You mentioned that this is something that, you know, buying a patent and then using it as a litigation tool is completely legal. So what are some of the structural ideas that have come about to limit the negative effects of patent trolls or NPEs?
I mean, there are quite a few. One is what's called a working requirement, which is basically just a requirement that in order to assert a patent, you actually have to be doing something with it other than asserting it. You see this to a limited extent in the ITC, in the International Trade Commission, which has a domestic industry requirement. But because of the way that that domestic industry requirement is applied at the ITC, you still see some non-practicing entities at the ITC. They can claim licensing activity. The other problem you run into there, and this is a legitimate concern, is universities are non-practicing entities, but they are also generally actual innovators. They're creating their own patents that they then go out and, in some cases, assert, and in many cases, successfully. I know the UC system, the University of California system, has a huge licensing program. My alma mater, the University of Michigan, has a licensing program. Wisconsin, a lot of universities license their patents very successfully because they tend to have actually innovative technologies, but they wouldn't qualify for a working requirement. Structurally, I think the biggest issue is really just making sure that the patents that are out there are valid and are actually new. That's the bigger concern. NPEs, a lot of the time, they rely on sort of corner cases. They rely on patent litigation being expensive, which it is, and they rely on that to extract settlement values. And they rely on broad patents that probably shouldn't have issued because they're easier to assert. They're easier to win a case on when the patent is very, and this is a software patent problem in particular, when a patent is kind of meaningless and you can argue it means whatever you want, it becomes very easy to say that somebody's product does what the patent claims.
So can you quickly just give us, you know, a lot of our listeners aren't familiar with the patent process. Could you give us an overview of, like, you know, it seems like if you're granted a patent, therefore, you know, that's a statement that you've made something new. Can you walk us through how, you know, some patents get through that aren't actually patentable material?
Sure. So the basic process is you go to a patent attorney, they write up an application with some set of claims when the claim is what you actually claim to own. The application, the specification, the long description, all the drawings, those are just to describe information about your patent. So you'll see headlines sometimes about Apple patented this or Amazon patented that, and they'll look at the title, but the title has nothing to do with what they actually claim to own. You have to look at the claims for that. So you take your claims, you go to the office. Sometime in the next couple years, the office will get back to you, and the examiner will have had a certain amount of time. It depends on exactly which examiner, what the area of technology is, but somewhere on the order of 15 to 30 hours, maybe a little bit more for some really complex technologies, to go out and look for prior art, for documents that existed before you claim, before your claimed invention, that disclose what you have claimed you invented. And the examiner will say, well, I looked, I found this document, and it shows everything that your claim says, so you don't get your patent. And the applicant will come back and say, well, okay, I'm going to change my claims in this way. Or they might say, well, you don't really understand what that prior art reference really discloses, or you don't understand what my claims mean. And that negotiation happens back and forth. But the examiner does have a very limited amount of time throughout this. I have, and I think Stephen has as well, litigated patent cases. I would regularly spend literally hundreds of hours looking for the right prior art to invalidate a claim. An examiner gets on the order of 20 hours to find the prior art and write up their response to the applicant and deal with all the paperwork, which all takes time. So they're getting significantly less time than private attorneys will spend later on. That's a large portion of the reason. Part of it is just resources. They only have so many resources. There's actually, I have a blog post going up soon, hopefully today, on a new prior art archive that Cisco and Google and MIT and the USPTO collaborated on. And the idea there is to provide prior art resources outside of patent documents. Examiners tend to rely on patent documents, but there's a lot out there, especially on the tech side of things, that's product manuals, web pages, standards proposals, all the sort of non-patent but really technically important documentation. So I think the big problem at the patent office is just a resource limit. It's examiners only have so much time. Their job is not that easy, and they have a limit on what they can find. So at the end of the day, there are going to be some patents that slide through because the examiner just couldn't find the art that should have been found based on these restrictions. And in some cases, I mean, examiners are humans. They make mistakes. Some of them try harder than others. And sometimes an examiner will let something through because the applicant just isn't going to take a no for an answer. So there's no way for an examiner to say permanently, okay, this is not going to go. This patent cannot be granted. The applicant can always come back, can always make a new proposal, make a new argument.